By the way, Will, do you want to take it this time, or do you want me to do it? All right, I'll lead the meeting this time. All right, so hello everyone to this week's W3C CCG meeting. Today, we're very excited to have Leonard and Eric from Adobe to present the latest developments on C2PA, or Coalition for Content Provenance and Authenticity. Before we get there, just want to quickly go through a couple agenda items. First of all, just a quick reminder on the Code of Ethics and Professional Conduct reminder. Just want to make sure that everyone makes respectful comments. I think we've been doing that for years, haven't had an issue, but it's always good to start the meeting with that quick reminder. Another quick reminder on the intellectual property note. Anyone can participate in these calls. However, all substantive contributions to any CCG work items must be member of the CCG with full IPR agreement signed. So if you have any questions in regards to getting a W3C account, or signing the community contributor license agreement, please feel free to pin any of the co-chairs here. A quick code note, these meetings are automatically being recorded and also transcribed. We will try to publish these meeting notes in the next 24 hours. I think we've been pretty good at that, but if you actually see any errors, in regards to the automatic transcription, please ping me, and then I'll try to correct it if it's a material error. We use GG Chat to queue the speakers during the call. So you can type in queue plus to add yourself to the queue, or queue minus to remove. I'll be the moderator. All right. A quick moment for the introductions or reintroductions. So if you're new to the community, or you haven't been active and want to re-engage with the community, please feel free to unmute and just introduce yourself. All right, any announcements or reminders? Anya, please.
Just a fairly regular reminder that the Verifiable Credentials Working Group is continuing to progress the various specifications through the standardization process. So we kind of reported out. Brent did a wonderful presentation last week and reported out on where we were in the standardization process and all the specifications that are being done. We are planning to go into candidate recommendation with the BBS cryptography suite this month, and then the Bitstring status list specification next month, and then that's in April, and then in May we will probably submit the final round of candidate recommendation specifications for the VC2O data model. So that's like, we're probably going to be like completely done with the VC data model spec in May, and potentially we'll put the data integrity specifications into another candidate recommendation round at that time. That will basically signal that we are done with those specifications. VC Cozy Hosey is expected to go into candidate recommendation sometime next month as well. So lots of stuff happening, lots of stuff getting locked in. If you're implementing, that's great. But now's really the time to start implementing against the test suites and things of that nature. That's it for the updates.
Thank you, Manu. Any other announcements or reminders? All right, a quick preview of what's coming at the CCG. So next week, we actually got the CEO of iProof to talk about biometric authentication. So we're going to switch the topic a little bit away, No, well, I had a new diverse topic, a little bit more controversial one. We got an expert in this field in regards to biometric authentication to talk about that. And then the week after that, we are going to talk about the Litherion and post-quantum verifiable credentials. And the week after that, we're going to talk about SSI for organizations, or prior requirements for enterprise software. And then we will have Benjamin to talk about VC Test Suite on April 2nd. All right, any other announcements or reminders? Any updates on the work items? All right, I think everyone can't wait for the main agenda. So again, today we're very excited to have Leonard and Eric from Adobe. I'll let them introduce themselves a little bit, but I think Leonard, you actually were one of the architects for the PDF format. So very obviously you're a very, very well-known figure, and we are very, very honored to have you here to talk about C2PA, Coalition for Content Provenance and Authenticity. Thank you. The floor is yours.
Thank you. And it's good to be back. I've been a member of this community for quite a long time, although a very quiet one. So it's always nice to be back and, as it were, see some familiar faces. So let me jump in here. I'm going to sort of set the stage, give some background, and talk about what we've been doing at the content, at the Coalition for Content Provenance and Authenticity, the C2PA, for a while now. And then I'm going to let Eric really spend most of the time talking about what he's been working on, which is identity and a new view that we have on identity for this work. So I'm going to assume everyone can see. So I'm going to go ahead and jump in here. So we're a C2PA was founded in 2021 as a standards body to focus on developing the technical specifications around content provenance and authenticity. Again, our name. And so we've been doing this for quite a while now. We have a partner organization called CAI. Some of you might be familiar with the Content Authenticity Initiative. I mention them just because sometimes people get them confused. You can think of the C2PA as the architects. We define the standards and do the technical work at the standards level. And the CAI is then we think of as the contractors or the builders, in that they work on implementations, and they work on education and outreach around those standards. A lot of members. We are at about 100 members to the C2PA, and you can see lots of logos on the screen. I certainly won't bore you with those. We also have established liaisons with the ISO, Etsy, and others. So we have tried to coordinate with a lot of other bodies, and of course W3C included, although those are more informal relationships than formal ones. We focus on, three pillars. Provenance, which is, of course, what we're going to talk most about. Education, and also policy. I'm not going to talk really about the other two. We're going to talk about provenance and how that applies. We also do not do detection. Detection is an arms race. The better your detector gets, the better people try to get better at beating it. So we don't want to go down that path. It is better to declare the truth, the history, the origin of content than it is to try to guess. And of course, provenance, if you're not familiar with the term, the who, the what, the where, the when, the how, and the why. So it's all the information you want about a given piece of content. When we went into this work, we very clearly did not want to reinvent any wheels. We did not want to design anything new, but instead rely on prior battle-tested techniques. And that's why we use well-established cryptography and signature technology, well-established packaging and serialization technologies, and even identity-related pieces that Eric will talk about. We do not require cloud storage or distributed ledgers or blockchains, but we allow for it. There are a number of implementations out there today that connect content, our what we call our manifests or our content credentials, with clouds and ledgers and blockchains. And that's great. And we're all in favor of that. But the standard itself is agnostic. And we need this to work across the history and the life cycle of any type of asset, whether that is an image, a video, an audio, a document, 3D, AR, VR, text. We are, again, agnostic to format as well. We are, so in 2021, we published our first version, version 1.0 of the spec. We just this year published version 2. So we're currently at version 2.0 of the core specification. That core specification is one of 8 documents. 2 of them are normative. 6 of them are informative. So we have explainers and we have guidance documents and we have documents discussing security and harms, as well as our core spec. And these are all available online, and you're more than welcome to, of course, please peruse them, file issues, concerns about them. If you have any, reach out to us. So what is this? It is a model for storing and accessing cryptographically verifiable and tamper-evident information whose trustworthiness can be assessed based on a defined trust model. Okay? What do we mean? What we mean is that we have a way to establish this thing called a content credential. That's the human term. Technically, under the hood, we call this a C2PA manifest. But basically, it's a set of assertions. It's a set of cryptographically hashed pieces of information. And they could be anything such as identity or the actions that were taken or ingredients that were used, or, you know, there are dozens of predefined assertions, and there are the ability to have custom information or assertions. So you put together all of these assertions that you'd like about a given piece of content. You then wrap these up in a claim. And so all of each assertion is hashed. The claim then hashes the entire assertion store and describes a bunch of other information, such as who is making the claim, what is making the claim, when is the claim being made. And then that is all digitally signed by the claim signature. So as you hear, we have a Merkle tree-like approach of hashes of hashes of hashes, all wrapped around with that final signature. So very common, well-understood technology. One of the things that we've added over the last year or so, because of what's happening in the world, and this should be no surprise, is specific functionality related to generative AI. Now, in this case, we don't use generative AI, but what we want is to enable content to identify itself as having either been created by or participating in, modified by generative AI systems. We do not only generative AI, but regular AI, all the way from the start of training all the way through to inference. But again, in this particular case, generative AI, big fancy terms. People like it. It's in the news. So we can establish whether or not, or it is established as part of that provenance, whether a given asset is created or modified by AI, and potentially even where that took place. We allow the establishment of what we call the recipe. So not only what was created, but how did you get there? For example, if you used a prompt, like in a text-to-image system, or you provided a reference image, all of that kind of thing could go in there. That's the recipe. And then there's the other side of the coin, which is to comply with laws like the European TDM, text and data mining law. We also support the ability for creators, publishers, and others to identify whether or not content can be trained or used for training or not, and under what circumstances. So complete mechanism for doing all of this. And again, this is all part of parcel of those assertions that I was talking about previously. As I mentioned, we support a lot of different formats. Some of the ones, this is not a comprehensive list, but you can see lots of different image formats, video formats, audio, documents, and even fonts themselves can have a manifest or content credential associated with it. You can even do it to plain text or JSON or anything can be have a manifest if it's not embedded. And for that reason, you can also store these in file systems, clouds, DLTs. You can reference them by URL or HTTP header or the like. So very, very flexible system, as I mentioned, allows for clouds, allows for DLTs, doesn't require it. So you can mix and match these pieces in a lot of different ways. And that's what people have done so far. This, as I mentioned, if it wasn't clear, the idea is that provenance grows over time. So you get a manifest at creation, you add another one at editing, another one at publishing, etc. And so when the user is finally consuming the content, they can see the complete history, the complete provenance of that asset. Just briefly, the cryptography we today use is based on the same model as the web. So we use standard hashes. We support a number of them. You know, certainly the SHA family is the most popular. We use X509 certificates. And again, we're modeled after things like browsers, PDF, et cetera, things that people know, understand, and are well established. But at the end of the day, trust isn't a yes or no. It's not a binary value. A human has to make the final decision about whether or not they trust a given asset. Instead, we provide, so all of these assertions, all of the cryptography, all of these pieces represent a series of signals we call trust signals that a user can view as part of the process. And you saw a UI that exists today for showing it. Not a mandated UI, but certainly one that we strongly recommend. And the user looks at that information, can consume it, can get more that information, and then make the final decision. And this is necessary because even you take two individuals looking at the exact same set of signals, and they can make two very different decisions. The example I like to give is here in the United States, if a take two people and they have a verified piece of content from CNN, one will say, I trust CNN. The other will say, I don't trust CNN. So it has nothing to do with the veracity or the provenance of the content. It has to do with their trust of the signer. And that makes perfect sense. And that's as it should be. One of the downsides, however, provenance is that it can become detached. Unfortunately, one of the things that a lot of systems today do is they strip provenance. They strip metadata because they don't know about it. It's new. It's different. They've never seen it before. And they don't do it on purpose. They just strip everything because they assume if it's not the actual image or it's not the actual video, don't need it. Throw it away. And so it's necessary to also consider how do you connect that provenance to an asset when it has been stripped or detached. And so we talk about a three-legged stool. In addition to that provenance, which is always there, we want to connect that with watermarking technology and we want to connect that with fingerprinting technology. And so we are working right now on a standard that connects open source as well as closed source commercial approaches to watermarking across various asset types and established standards so that there can be a common way to represent the manifest within a watermark, find it, and retrieve it, regardless of which approach is used. So that's one of our biggest efforts right now. There are lots of implementations of the technology already out there today. Large companies, of course, you may know of Adobe and Microsoft, hardware manufacturers such as Qualcomm, Leica has it embedded in their cameras, open source tooling like EXIF tool, and many others. are out there already implementing this technology, and many more to come. People have announced support, including OpenAI, Google, and others. So, well-established solution. So let me just wrap up, and then I'm going to let Eric jump in to give you an idea of where identity fits into this and where we're going, because I know that's the most important thing to many of you. So as I said, we are establishing the core standards to establish provenance in a variety of different content types, including live and streaming content. And we are not only working to standardize it ourselves, I didn't mention this, but we're also working with the ISO so that for those countries that require something through a formal SDO, that can also be addressed. So I'm going to stop here. Eric, I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to you, and then we'll take Q&A at the end.
That sounds good. Thank you, Leonard. And let me go ahead and share my screen. Give me a moment. I'm new to Jitsi, so I have to find...
the screen with an arrow at the bottom.
Yeah, I see that. And I'm choosing the content to share. Let's see. Do you see, I'm hoping to share a keynote window on a second screen here.
No, not yet.
Okay. Sorry about that. I'm sharing the Jitsi.
You're sharing your screen.
Sorry about that. Let me see if I can find the other screen here. Oh, okay. I'll just do it this way.
Yep.
That works. Please.
Okay. Do you see Identity 2.0 assertion?
We did, and then you switched over to Slack.
Oh, sorry about that. Okay. Is that now? Yes. Okay. That looks like what I intended to share.
Yep.
Okay. Let me just make sure that I don't get notices while we're presenting. Okay. So, yeah, so I'm here to talk, as Leonard said, about how we are rethinking identity and how it will eventually fit into the overall C2PA manifest ecosystem. So let's talk about, we've been referring to this internally at Adobe as the Identity 2.0 assertion. And so I'll share with you some of the thought that we have about the current work. Why are we doing this? To start off, the real concern that we have and the flaw that we saw with the creative work assertion as defined in earlier versions is that we want to make sure that any statement of identity is securely bound to the content. So in this version, and I'll talk to that in a moment, we're requiring that the credential holder sign something that is uniquely bound to the content that it is describing. And then the other piece, as Leonard mentioned, the C2PA 2.0 specification moved more and more in the direction of what is machine attestable. So this is a specification that is outside of the process of C2PA itself to allow C2PA to focus on that which is machine attestable. So what is it that we're trying to describe? And this is our sort of core statement of our mission as defined in the design goals. It's a lot of words. I'm going to move through and highlight a few of those words specifically. First, we're talking about an actor, which is a human or non-human that is participating in the ecosystem. Typically, in this context, we mean an individual or an organization that is creating content, but that is not a necessary condition. In this specification, we refer to as a C2PA asset, as any asset containing the C2PA manifest data structure that Leonard spoke to earlier. And importantly, this is a separate trust signal from the claim generator's signature stating that the hardware or software was responsible for the overall implementation of the C2PA specification for that asset. This is intended as a trust signal for that individual organization or whatever other actor separately wants to make a statement that they are an actor, a participant in the creation of this content. The assertion is designed to be independently verifiable by whoever happens to come across that piece of content at a later time. And then the spec encourages the use of credentials that attest to the identity of the credential holder, either by an employer, by a professional organization, by a know-your-customer vendor, so on and so forth. And then it provides independent signals that the content is the same as the actor originally intended to produce. So if the content is somehow modified afterwards, signatures will fall apart and the identity assertion becomes invalid. So a quick overview of this and how it fits into the overall C2PA data model. So Leonard spoke earlier to how assertions work and how a claim and a claim signature are generated. Basically, this assertion does the same thing, but using the credentials of that actor that we spoke to a moment ago. So an identity assertion contains a list of other assertions in that same C2PA manifest that the credential holder is signing on their own behalf. And it is meant to be an additional and separate trust signal from the one that the C2PA claim generator creates. Currently, as defined in drafts of the identity assertion, we are using two forms of credentials, those being X509 certificates that yield COSI signatures, basically the same that the C2PA claim generator itself does. And then in a fast follow version of the spec, we'll be adding verifiable credentials, which will generate a new VC that is specific to the content being described. And again, that signature is saying by hash link, here are the other assertions that describe important parts of the content that the credential holder is attesting to. Importantly, one of the things that must be done is the in this diagram shown as the C2PA hash boxes assertion. That assertion binds the content to the remainder of the asset that is not the C2PA manifest store itself. And that's basically the signal that, the content itself is the content that was intended to be described by this credential holder. A couple of important things. This identity assertion, by not being directly part of the C2PA specification, is intended as an optional signal. So, you know, if there are cases where revealing identity could be harmful, the content creator is free to not use it. It can also be repeated many times. So you might imagine an interactive authoring tool that has multiple users. A tool such as that could, if the authors of that tool chose to do so, could remember which steps each participant took along the way and then generate separate, for instance, actions assertions that describe the steps that each participant took and ask those participants to sign on their behalf for those specific actions. That could also be used to state things through a metadata assertion, such as copyright or other intent. And finally, if, for instance, a reporter or a photojournalist in the field happens to identify themselves through an identity assertion and a subsequent publisher decides that for privacy or safety or even business reasons that that assertion should not be revealed when they republish this, there is a mechanism through C2PA to redact assertions, and that is intentionally available here so that identity can be redacted. So who is building this? I mentioned a moment ago, this is not a C2PA project. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. It's been my full-time work for the last few months, and some preliminary discussions have happened at Internet Identity Workshop, and I see a few names of people that I have met in that context. We had a Content Authenticity Initiative Summit in December where it was previewed. And it has now become a public and independent group called the Creator Assertions Working Group. This is governed under the Community Specification License process. It has also taken up other assertions that were part of C2PA 1.x and are not part of C2PA 2.0, those being the some of the assertions that Leonard spoke to earlier around trading and data mining intent, endorsements, and unrestricted metadata assertion. And we have weekly meetings. I have seen a couple of people from this group appear there. I would love the expertise of people who are here to join us at the time stated above. I will note that the time is shifting next Monday for those who are not in North America because the U.S. is adopting daylight savings time this weekend. So 15:30 UTC or 8:30 in the morning, U.S. Pacific, 11:30 U.S. Eastern. Contact me for more information. My last name is Skeeton at adobe.com. And I can explain more details from that. And with that, I will unshare and open it up for discussion.
Bonnie, please.
Hey, Leonard, Eric, fantastic presentation.
Thank you.
Really, really cool stuff. In very areas, both of you know. So I'm wondering what two questions. The first one is, how can this community help further? I'm sure we can, you know, go to meetings and things of that nature, but I'm sure you'd love to hear, you know, how some of the things this community is working on that could be used with C2PA, how that work's going. So like, you know, regular email for the mailing list so that we could provide feedback, I think would be certainly welcome. The first question is, how can we help? And the second question is, what do you see, as the biggest challenges over the next 6 months, with the identity assertion specification specifically?
Certainly. I'll take that. I think the biggest challenge is making sense of the diversity of standards that are out there and what are the pieces of that that are most relevant to the use cases that we've discussed here. How can we build a standard that is comprehensible and easily implemented?
Yeah, and I think, as Eric said, I think right now this is the identity work is one of the, you know, the highest priorities in our area. And so getting all of the help that we can get there is absolutely welcome. And I think Eric will put them in chat if he gets a chance. But the new identity specification that he talked about is publicly viewable in draft format. And I know he would absolutely love all, I speak for him, but would absolutely love all of the feedback, file issues, send the mail. Whatever's easiest. So that would be a huge help.
Yes, I will post. You spoke very well for me there. I will post the link to the current draft in the chat. And then, yes, I will also post a note for how to join the group.
All right, Dimitri, you're next on the queue.
Thanks, Eric and Leonard. Thank you so much for presenting. I think a lot of us in this community are really excited about this work. Two questions. One is, you mentioned hash links in the whole infrastructure, and I was just wondering which hash link format you're using. And then question number two, I think a lot of us on this call are super curious about is, where do you see DIDs playing a role in the identity infrastructure?
So I'll take the first one.
Okay.
My fault, and then I'll take the second one. So I a quick history. When we started the work, we were using JSON as our serialization format. And so I connected up with Manu. And so as far as I know, my name is still on the hashlink draft specification for actually how to do that as a single URL. And that was where we started. However, when we switched our serialization from JSON to CBOR, we recognized that we could take advantage of CBOR's binary structure. So we've defined our own object, you know, CBOR object with fields for algorithm and hash. So it's the same concepts, but it's now expressed as a CBOR object instead of a single string. Same ideas though.
Got it. Are you intending to make a standalone spec for that or contribute that to the idea draft?
Honestly, we had nobody's approached us about being interested in using it in addition, but we would have no objection to doing that at all. Happy to do it.
And what about DIDs?
Great. Send, yeah,
so, yeah, that I'll take that one. So DIDs are VCs are really only now relevant in the identity assertion space. They are no longer part of the C2PA specification. As for DIDs, part of the reason, well, let me back up. We made the decision in the Creator Assertions Working Group recently to have two versions of the identity assertion draft going forward. And the idea is that the version 1.0 will use essentially the same X509 and COSI signature infrastructure that C2PA does for organizations that have that infrastructure at hand. And also because that infrastructure was already well thought through in the C2PA 1X cycle. So we can have a mechanism for the overall trust infrastructure there fairly quickly, and then take the time that it takes to really think through the VC part of the specification, which is has generated the most questions, the question you've raised being among them. The challenge with DIDs is the last time that I looked, there's something like 180 published DID methods, and it's difficult to provide guidance as to which ones to favor, which ones to support, which ones to require. And we haven't come up with answers that are satisfying to those questions yet. So that's actually an area of active discussion in this group. And if people here have perspectives on that, that would be helpful to us sort of narrowing the scope of the spec to something that is comprehensible and easily implementable. That would be very, very welcome.
I will say one other thing that, so Eric is right that the primary focus for DIDs is over in identity. That said, there is still a support for using a DID as a content identifier in the core C2PA spec. So every asset is assigned a unique identifier and it can be any identifier. We don't mandate where it comes from, what it looks like, anything. We just say, stick an identifier here and tell us where it's coming from. And DIDs are one of a series of options that we suggest. Here's a couple to choose from. DIDs, handles, DOI, and ISCC are four that we call out, but even those aren't mandated.
All right, Mahmood, I think you're on the queue.
Awesome, thank you. Wonderful presentation, I appreciate it very much. I had a question about the redaction side. You mentioned that you can do after-the-fact redaction. Can I ask, is that happening at the point of presentation or exchange, or is that... Can you talk a little bit more about how that works and what really we can expect from that?
Yeah, happy to do that. So there's no mandate on to when redaction takes place. The idea is that somewhere later on in the life cycle of an asset, the current, I won't use the word holder, the current person who has the asset and wants to continue it through its life cycle recognizes that there is some information currently in the provenance that needs to be removed. So the normal example of this is that, a publisher is about to publish a photo taken in a war zone and recognizes that the photographer's name is still in there. And if they left it in, that could be detrimental to their health. So they want to redact out that information before they send it on. That might also include, you know, removing or blurring a face or, you know, some other aspect. But that was the use case why we put it in there. That said, there are other reasons why you might want to do it in various use cases or flows. So no, don't care when, but if you choose to, there's a defined way to do it.
Is this a two-way operation? Can I unredact afterwards?
No, then it would not be good redaction.
Okay. Thank you.
Related to that, I'll just mention that that is done as part of the production of a subsequent manifest. So the next creator, if you will, or the next producer of that content will also make a statement saying that they have redacted that. And of course, that doesn't include what the previous content was. The other piece to mention is that if the original asset that had that original assertion present is independently in circulation, the redaction has no impact on that manifest.
Is there a way to link from the new manifest to the old manifest?
Yes, it happens within when you, in the establishment of the provenance, each piece is linked to the other through what we call, I used the term ingredient before. So one type of ingredient is a parent ingredient, which is how that things chain to each other.
Thank you. That was all my questions.
Bonnie, you're next.
I think Brent and maybe Harrison, you, and then me.
Okay. All right, Brent.
Apologies if this is a too basic a question. So I have a PDF I would like to make some assertions about the content. I produce a CCPA, C2PA manifest. How are those two documents associated as far as the mod? Like, is the manifest inside the PDF? Is the PDF inside the manifest? Where are the signatures? How does this all fit together?
Yeah, great question. So the recommendation, and it's not mandated in any way, but our preferred model is that the manifest goes inside the asset. So in this case, the manifest goes into the PDF and the specification, the C2PA spec says in the case of PDF, it goes here. So it gives you a specific place in the PDF data structures. And it does that for all of those formats I listed earlier. So here's how to put it in a JPEG. Here's how to put it in an MP4 video, et cetera. But you don't have to. If there are reasons why you would like to keep the two detached for some reason, for example, you want to keep the manifest in the cloud or put it on a DLT, you can do that too. But the normal scenario is it goes into a specific place in the PDF, for your example, and that manifest is signed. It's a self-contained blob, which includes a digital signature. In the case of PDF, you can also apply a PDF signature on top of that and then connect the two as well. So there's actually, and the spec talks about the details of how the two types of signatures work in conjunction with each other.
Thank you.
Yep.
So I have a related question. So let's say a document has a long history of edits or forks. In other words, there's a lot of manifests. Does all those manifests go with the document? And if so, are there like implications to the speed and performance when you're checking the provenance?
Excellent question. So again, as we mentioned, it's not mandatory that it all be included. Again, you could start sticking out in the cloud if you've got certain workflows. But yes, if it all goes there and it's got a long history, that could get large. We do support compression. So we have a model for compressed manifests to reduce the size specifically. And then with respect to validation, there's the only thing that's required to be validated is the top level manifest, what we call the active manifest. There is no mandate to walk the entire chain at validation time. Usually the user just cares, has this thing been modified since the last time, and tell me who signed it. And that's what I care about. However, there are user experiences where you can dive into it and walk the entire chain. And then in that case, you would probably do level by level or ingredient by ingredient validation. And again, that's all described in the spec.
Got it. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Anya, you're next.
Yeah, going back to Eric's question around, or just statement around, there are 180 plus DID methods, which is true, and it's really hard to pick between them, which is also true. I'm looking at the model here, and I mean, it is X509 cert based, right? I mean, there's a trust model here that's X509 cert based, and I'm wondering if that could be a filtering function on the DID methods. Specifically, if we look at what's being deployed today, there seems to be a certain amount of confidence that deploying did web is an okay first step. It doesn't mean it's the final step and it's the end all be all, but if you're using X509 certs and those certs could be exposed through, you know, the standard, you know, DNS, X509, you know, infrastructure, then that might be a good place to start. An ephemeral did method could also be one of those things, but it feels to me like did web would be a good fit for, like, let's start here and then go out instead of, like, which one of these 180 methods do we want to, you know, propose first. Has that discussion happened in the group yet?
So the draft of the spec that I wrote before we opened it up to the public discussion did, in fact, recommend did web as the primary recommended method. I think I also put in a reference to did web s, although I've heard less support actively for that. So, you know, that's one of the areas of discussion that we'll come to when we circle back to VCs as credentials. I think you're right, though. You know, our own intent, I think, at Adobe is probably to use did web as the primary method of credentials, but still lots to be determined there.
Mahesh, you're next on the queue.
Yes, great presentation. Thank you, guys. Had a question about verification. As a user, when I view a document, a video, is verification run as part of this and then a logo displayed? I mean, how does that work for a regular person who doesn't want to kind of open up the whole, you know, the manifest and things of that nature?
Absolutely. That's a great question. So the user, we have a whole one of those documents I mentioned before. It's called our user experience guidelines. And so it goes into quite a lot of detail about the questions you're asking. And so the way we address it is we have multiple levels. So if you're familiar with the concept of levels of disclosure in UX, so level one is just what we call a pin. It's a simple logo or icon that would be associated with it. So a user could look very quickly and see, yes, this piece of content has credentials or it doesn't have credentials. And potentially, are those credentials valid or not valid? Or what, you know, there's a little X or something on them. So like very quick view. There's a level two, which is where depending on the experience, rather than just putting up that pin, a UX could display information like who was the signer. So it might say, you know, and the time and date in addition to the logo. And you know, that depends on the user experience scenario. And then levels three and level four is where you get into all of the details of the manifest and the histories and the, you know, ingredients and everything. So yes is the short answer. And hopefully the longer one also gave you some context.
Thank you.
Manu.
So I'm wondering what the logical conclusion to this work is, right? I mean, so the presumption is this is going to be successful and it's going to be out there and there is going to be content that where you can verify the authenticity of it and there is going to be content where you can't. And given, you know, where generative AI is going and how good it's getting and how rapidly it's getting there, what do both of you think is the end game here? Are we going to be looking at our devices and the device is going to warn us, hey, the thing you're about to watch, we have no idea where it came from. It could be generated, that kind of thing, such that everything will need some form of content authenticity for us to watch it. Like, I can see this happening in news. I'm wondering if, you know, like, it could be equally useful in shorts where we thought the short was for entertainment purposes, but it's actually providing some kind of social nudge one way or the other as to what we think. So where do you think the logical conclusion is here?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll give you my opinion. So this is a personal opinion. It's not the opinion of an organization. My personal opinion is that I believe it is important that content provide provenance. Just like if I were to go buy something at an auction, I want the, like the pictures on the wall behind me all came with provenance. I know where they came from. I know that they're real and certified. I personally want to see that on my content so that when I care, I can go and look for it. So if I happen to be on a website that I trust, you know, if I go to the BBC, for example, I trust the BBC. I'm on their site. I'm not so concerned that every single picture and every single video I'm looking at on that site has provenance because I trust the site. But if I'm on Facebook or Instagram or pick your favorite social media, I'm more concerned about it because I might see all sorts of things coming through that I don't necessarily trust the sender or it's a friend of a friend or whatever. And then, yes, I would want to see that information. That said, I don't think we ever want it mandated. I think mandating that gets us into all sorts of, controlled democracies or whatever, totalitarian regimes, and that doesn't work. But I think the more that it's out there, the more that it is available to people who want it and care about it, it makes for a better world.
If I can add to that, I speak to people across many, many sectors, not just news media, but from governments, from entertainment, from sports venues, influencers of various kinds, all of whom are having the sense that they're losing contact with their audiences because their names, their reputations, their likenesses are being stolen and contorted and reused to tell stories that aren't authentically theirs. So from the content production side, there's a very strong interest in having some way of standing apart from this onslaught of generative and otherwise, misleading content. The other piece I'll say is, I look back, I happen to be refreshing some content I'd written on the internet 10, 15 years ago, and I was stunned when I looked at that at the number of plain HTTP links that I linked to at that time without really thinking about it too much. And today, that's something that kind of raises an eyebrow, right? I want to have some sense that it is, in fact, the BBC website that I'm looking at. And not somebody who's intercepted the DNS traffic along the way and presented me some other content. And I think when I think about the work that we're doing here in C2PA and the related organizations, my hope is that there will be a similar thought process that goes into viewing content that isn't marked with content credentials, that will be more discerning in asking questions about how things got to us, as Leonard spoke to earlier.
So I have a quick follow-up question. Actually, I have two questions. One is, I'm assuming some creators probably would love this because they will be able to show that they are the original creator of this content and actually get some licensing money out of it. So I'm curious if this actually has the ability to actually couple with payments. And then the second is a little bit unrelated, which is, Leonard, in your previous presentation, in your presentation, you showed like a three pillars. One is provenance. The second one is watermarking. And the third one is fingerprinting. Like, what is fingerprinting? Because when you went over provenance, you showed a slide on watermarking. Can you clarify what fingerprinting is?
Absolutely. So I'll answer them in that order. So the first question is that C2PA very specifically does not want to get into the business of DRM or payments or rights management or anything in that field. However, the underlying technology is absolutely designed to allow for it if someone wants to build upon it. And in fact, we've talked to a number of companies out there already who are in the midst of building ownership, authorship, payment systems, et cetera, that leverage our provenance technology. So yes and no in that regard with respect to payments. So fingerprinting is really just a fancy term for similarity checking. So if you think about going on to a Google or a Bing or whatnot and doing, you know, have you ever seen an image like this one before? That's what fingerprinting is. It says, find me something like this. And so that way, if you've, the watermark has been destroyed, the provenance has been destroyed, find me something that looks like this. And then again, as a human, I can make a determination.
Got it. Thank you. And we'll take one last question. Ted.
Just quickly, you had mentioned something a minute ago about credibility on the web. You might find interesting the Credible Web community group, which I've thrown a link into chat for.
Yeah, you're calling that out, Ted. You and I have both been members of that group since its inception.
Oh, okay, great.
Thank you for calling it out. I mean, it's gone through some waves and ups and downs. It is a very important organization, and I'm hoping that we can kick it back off.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Leonard. Thank you, Eric, for a great presentation. And also thank you for leading this great discussion. Thanks for taking the time. It's definitely very, very interesting. We will publish the meeting minutes and the recordings, both video and audio recordings, in the next 24 hours. And if you have any questions, feel free to, reach out to me first, and then I'll forward it to Leonard and Eric. All right, this concludes this week's TCG meeting, and we'll see you next week. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, everyone.